This evening, we're going to think about this issue, future life. Where is there real hope? Future life. Delighted to introduce Paul and Angela Wong. Come and join us, join me at the front here, Paul and Angela. Thank you so very much for being prepared to be interviewed. You were part of this congregation a few years back.
That's right, and we've graduated.
Angela grew up here in the UK. Angela's parents, you won't have necessarily have heard of the Vietnamese boat people, but Angela's parents came from Vietnam and then Cambodia. She'll tell you about this in a moment, and were literally plucked out of the sea and brought to Bournemouth in their... All they had was the clothes they stood in, and that's Angela's backstory. We'll hear about it in a minute. She ended up going to Cambridge, studying law and working at Linklaters. So we're looking forward to hearing all of this. Paul, a very different sort of background, grew up in Singapore. He'll tell us about that in a moment. Studied law in Cambridge, went off to Linklaters, where he was involved in capital markets and kind of preparing companies for general listing and all that sort of stuff you read about in the papers, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that there is Paul. Now, Angela, I've given a little bit of a backstory, but, you know, from mum and dad, in 1979, just in the clothes they were in, sort of very contemporary with the Ukraine situation, in a warehouse in Bournemouth, you ending up at Robinson College in Cambridge and studying law. I mean, give us the sort of A to B, if you would.
Yeah, sure, I'll try. to understand, I guess, my story, you really need to understand the hardship and my parents' story. So I come from a big Chinese family. And actually, both my parents were from wealthy backgrounds, actually. My mum was born in Cambodia, but it was during the Khmer Rouge, the Pol Pot dictatorship, and they took everything. They fled. The family fled the country to Vietnam, where they found another difficult government after the communist won the Vietnam War. And so, but my mum also met my dad in the process. And they decided, we're going to make a better life for ourselves now. So they paid a lot of money to board this tiny boat that was actually for 100, really, but there were 500 people on it. And then 3 days in, they realized that the boat was starting to fill with water and they needed rescuing. And miraculously, a British cargo ship on the way to Japan found them, rescued them, along with 1,000 other boat people. And that's the backdrop to my upbringing. This idea that you've got nothing. You need to rely on yourself now. And they work really, really, really hard to provide for themselves and their families.
What did they do when they came to live in England? I mean, how did they make ends meet?
Well, you know, my mum had 3 jobs. They both started off as kitchen porters in Shell. Back then, they didn't let married couples work together, so one was in one place and one was in another. And after the Shell shift, 9 to 5 ended, my mum would do an evening cashier job in Long Fong, which is one of the Chinese supermarkets in Chinatown, still exists today. And then after that, she would sell cinema tickets in Odeon till 2 a.m. And I just found out that they were so sweet to my dad, they let him watch a movie whilst he was waiting for her so that she wouldn't take the bus back by herself. But they worked really, really hard. And so we grew up thinking we have to actively make our future better by working hard and studying hard, because mum and dad never got the opportunity to.
And obviously we've talked, it's been lovely getting to know, I've known you for years, but lovely getting to know you better. I mean, they actually ended up bringing the whole family across.
Yeah, so part of the reason why my mum had to work so hard was because she was trying to sponsor her family, siblings over, because mum is one of 10 and dad is one of 12. And not everybody ended up in the UK, but they ended up out of Vietnam, which was the main aim. So for the longest time, I never stayed in a hotel going anywhere, traveling. We just had family, Australia, America, France, everywhere.
So you get anywhere in the world, we say, we're friends of Angela, and we're welcome. That's wonderful.
On the floor, yeah.
Now, Paul, your story is kind of really radically different. So give us a picture of your background.
Sure. Thanks, William. Yeah, my background is very, very different to Angela's. I grew up in Singapore in what I guess most people would consider to be very comfortable circumstances. Some people would say I'm quite privileged in my upbringing. I never knew any need. Like Angela's parents, my parents worked really, really hard to provide for everything that I needed growing up. And by all accounts, my upbringing was just very, very comfortable. Yeah, so quite different. Most people know Singapore from the film Crazy Rich Asians. I recommend the book. I think the book is a great read. I remember buying it at the airport, reading it cover to cover, because it captured so perfectly that slice of Singaporean society. And I grew up around that. I wasn't in there, but I grew up around there. I went to the school that's in the book. I went to the church that's in the book.
It's so, beginning. It's beginning to sound, if you don't mind me saying. We've been friends for a long time, so I'm just gonna tread carefully here. But, and you ended up going to Queen's College in Cambridge.
That's right. So I came to the UK in 2004. I came to study law. And my kind of outlook on life coming here was very much, I need to work hard. I need to prove my worth. I need to be somebody. And that was the kind of thing that I was chasing. And the reason I was like that, I think, is because even though I'd grown up going to church, even though I don't remember a time that where I don't remember a Sunday that I didn't go to church, the kind of Christianity that I grew up with was very much clear on Jesus Christ saves me from God's judgment, which of course he does, but maybe less clear on the fact that actually he's in charge of my life. He's my king, and that my priorities need to fit in with his. And so really, I just grew up most of my life, even coming down to London to take up a solicitor's job. I just had a big, I called myself a Christian, I had a Christian label on me. But really inside, I was just like my friends, my non-Christian friends, my colleagues, the things I wanted out of life, my ambitions, my heart's desires, just the same as everyone else's, really.
Angela, what about your background? I mean, what did you know? I mean, Paul obviously knew something of Jesus, but what was your... what did you know of Jesus growing up?
I think similar to many other British-born Chinese BBCs, you know, we had, I grew up with a whole mixed bag of Chinese beliefs. So Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism. What that looked like in practice was that we had a red altar at home where we would burn incense to ancestors. We would offer food on the anniversary of their death to remember them. I remember specifically asking for my driving exam to be on a certain day, a certain time, according to the Chinese divination calendar, where it was good for taking driving exams. And
we've run this interview a couple of times, and it just occurred to me, you know, does that mean if we... You know, if you're out driving, we really should only try and make sure we meet you on a particular day of the year. And
it's sort of gone downhill since I passed my driving exam, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, we took it really seriously. And yeah. I was also, because my mum was working a lot, my grand-auntie flew over from New Zealand. That's where she ended up, to look after me. And she was a devout Buddhist for most of her life. So I followed her in trying to be a vegetarian on the 1st and the 15th of every month and avoid sort of pungent foods like garlic and, you know, so we took it quite seriously. That was my way of kind of moderation. But I had, no exposure to Jesus growing up other than from the media, which wasn't positive. For the longest time, I didn't know that Jesus was a man. I thought he was a swear word that everybody just said whenever they felt like it. And I definitely didn't think that he was real. I thought that society had made it up. You know, quite a good story, but to kind of help people the way that my cultural rituals help my family.
Just give us a sense of, with the kind of ancestors and so forth, and you said you actually, you know, would burn money for your ancestors and so forth. What's behind that?
Yeah, so on the anniversary of the ancestors' death or a particular festival where lots of people do it all together, you would burn money or you know, in places like Singapore, you can even buy Mercedes, like paper models of Mercedes cars and mansions to burn to your ancestors, to give it to them in their afterlife. So there was this idea that there was a place after people had died, and your way of kind of contributing to it and looking after your family and doing your bit is by providing these things. And also as a way to remember people, because just the separation is hard for families.
So, Paul, you know what happened to change this? I mean, you didn't actually have a real label saying Christian on you, but it metaphorically, you thought you were Christian and so forth, but actually a double life. Tell me what happened to change.
Yeah, that's right. So I was working as a solicitor in London. I worked very, very hard. I was trying to prove to myself or maybe my parents that I could be somebody, just chasing the dream, as it were. And it was really quite an empty existence at the end of the day. You're living for the next holiday, basically, like everybody else in the office is. And one of my Christian colleagues, like properly Christian colleagues, I think he could see that something is not right here, and said, look, you come to work on a Sunday, you go back to the office, you go to church, and then you come back again. Just go to the church up the road, which is St. Helens. It's much closer. So I said, okay, let's try that. And I remember exactly where I sat that first 6 p.m. service I came. It's right in the sort of third row from the back. Yeah, I'm pointing at you. But third row from the back, middle block. And I remember leaving the service thinking, gosh, people here really take Jesus' words very, very seriously. And they're not afraid to say hard things to me. And that got me hooked. I also remember thinking the people who were speaking up here were clearly very intelligent. And that held a certain amount of attraction for me.
Just you did tell me earlier that you didn't hear me speak for a long time.
It wasn't you. So
just which was a bit of a, there I was thinking, no.
That's right. And so I just kept coming. I just kept coming along. I just kept, Jesus' words explained to me were I was hooked. I just wanted to learn more about what he had to say about who I was and how I was to live my life. And I attended Bible study, and we came to that portion in Mark's gospel where Jesus defines what a Christian is. And definitions are important to lawyers. So you listen up when you get a definition there. And Jesus says, whoever wants to come after me must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And gosh, I thought, that's the definition of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And if that's the definition, then there's a problem, because my life doesn't fit that. I never denied myself anything for his sake or for the sake of the gospel. I'm living life on my own terms for the here and now. And that was when things began to change for me. My heart priorities began to change, the way I spent my time and my energy and my money, and eventually, decided that telling people about Jesus full time was the right thing to do with my life.
Just as you look back to what you were aiming for in life, and your big goals and so forth, what would you say now, from with Christian lenses on, of the Paul Wong back then?
Gosh, what would I say? It's a great question, William. I think when I look back, I would have asked Paul Wong to the question, what are you doing this for, or who are you doing this for, and what will you do once you've achieved it? Because looking back, I think I was living life both for myself and maybe also to meet the expectations of other people, my parents, my boss, perhaps the approval of my colleagues. And when you think about that, like, what is the point of attaining those things? What's the point of attaining their approval if you're not going to attain the approval of the maker of the universe, the one whose opinion actually matters, the one who made you and knows you inside out? I think that's what I would have asked, 25, 26-year-old Paul Wong.
Now, Angela, what changed? Here you are sitting right here talking about Jesus. So what changed?
Well, I can't believe I'm actually sitting here talking about Jesus, because I would have bet my life savings I'd never become a Christian back then. But I met Christians at work, and I was really surprised to hear them believe all these strange claims in the Bible, not as fairy tales, but as history. Mm. And the thing that really challenged me was actually they had reasons to give me for these beliefs. And it really made me think back to my own beliefs and ask, you know, what reasons do I have for mine? And actually, I didn't have many. The main thing that kept me believing was just that it was familiar. So I never questioned whether or not they were historically true. I was invited to Christianity Explored at another law firm, which had good sandwiches, and so I attended. And then the Bible studies here in Mark. And I was really fascinated at first intellectually at just how the Bible as one big story fit together. You know, to a lawyer, consistency is really important. And as I read the Bible, I just thought, how on earth can 66 different books written by different people over different periods of time all be consistently saying and talking about the same person, Jesus? So it's very hard to make up. And it was very interesting as a lawyer to see that level of consistency. And as a person of another faith, I think I was really surprised to meet this person who I never knew growing up, but seemed to know so much about me, my thoughts.
This
my
is worries. Jesus who you met in the scriptures. Yeah.
So when we were reading Mark and understanding Jesus' life and his purpose and what he sees in people, you know, it just explained so much of my own thoughts and the world that I saw around me. And it answered lots of big questions that I never knew I had about life. So, you know, the origins of life, what we're here for now, why we're all of equal worth, what happens after you die. I've never had those questions satisfactorily answered. Mm, right. But also I never really thought about them in the first place, you know, properly.
So both objectively true, the legal mind, evidentially based, but also subjectively, experientially true to life, which is fascinating. Now, just in this issue of future life and hope beyond life, what would you say to somebody who's sitting here thinking, well, future life, you know, what hope is there beyond life? How has becoming a Christian changed that for you?
I think normal people don't want to think about future life after they die. You know, that you might want to change your future now, what you can see. And so, you know, we do all these things to affect our future now, the way that my sister and I and our family did growing up. You know, you just want to do what you can to change this future. But actually learning about the Bible and that timeline is stretched, you know, the real future is the one that doesn't end. And then you can't actually do anything. But what I learned from the Bible is, you know, like my parents stranded on the South China Sea, that actually very little is in your control. The things that have been given to you, the things you'll experience. And there was nothing that I could do that could guarantee my eternal future, no matter how much good I did or how much work I did. Because heaven belongs to God, because he's the one who made it. And his standards are, they're naturally perfect. Why would he be anything less than perfect? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was the fact that Jesus achieves it all means that there is a great future which you don't have to work for, but it's a glorious one.
That's really helpful. Actually, Angela, you said a lot more about that this morning, and so it'd be worth just tuning into that. You mentioned earlier when we were talking at the 4 o'clock meeting that death was kind of almost like a completely non-subject in your house. Just very briefly, tell us about that.
Yeah, we avoided talking about death like the plague. And, you know, every time someone said the D word, then you'd hear a Cantonese choy and you don't want to hear any more about that.
What does choy mean?
I don't know if anybody knows what choy means. It just means unlucky, don't say it. Yeah, you know, stop the talking, taboo, something like that.
Okay. So in a nutshell, if you had to say to somebody, this is the Christian faith, what would you say it is?
I would say it's the greatest rescue story the world has ever seen. From eternal death to eternal life, you just have to recognize that you're sinking in a boat.
Well, Angela, we could go on talking. That is so beautifully put. Thank you. Paul, do you want just one final thing to say, just that you haven't touched on yet?
Well, we're gonna hear tonight about Jesus' power over life and death. And I think no one in history has died and come back to life to tell us about the afterlife. And that impacts how we live our life now. So I just want to say, you know, if there is an eternal future that Jesus promises and he's come back to tell us about it, then that's where you're going to put your, that's the basket you're going to put your eggs in. And that affects how you live now. So listen to what he has to say. It's of eternal.
Do you want to stay up here and give the talk, Paul? Great. Look, thanks so much. Shall we say a big thank you to Paul and Andrew? It's a really big thing for them to come. Thank you.
Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary quickly rise and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did not I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go."
When I'm 10 or 15 years ago, were we to ask about future life and real hope, I suspect many might have suggested that hope can be found in humanity. The end of the 20th century into the early 21st, the human project was full steam ahead. And at least in the West, humanity was on a roll. I remember quoting from a guy called Francis Fukuyama back in the early 2000s. He wrote an essay that has become famous more recently called The End of History. The essence was, we've nailed it. That kind of time, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton, together with the German Chancellor, developed foreign policy that spoke of a global village, free trade, international harmony, the world at one. In fact, I remember in 2005 being given a ride by, paying for a ride, obviously, by a taxi driver. And, it, you know, as you get chatting, he and his family had bought an apartment in Turkey. And I remember coming back and talking about it at home and saying, 2005, I mean, for how many decades over the last 300 years might this family have been able to visit their apartment in Turkey? It was very ambitious. And in that period, you know, people were planning trips down through Africa from north to south, through Libya and all these places. And today, of course, the picture is radically different. 9/11, 7/7, the global financial crisis, austerity, the pandemic, war, inflation, interest rates. We haven't even mentioned global warming, Trump, Brexit, potential food riots, or monkeypox. Perhaps more than anything in the last couple of years, we've had brought to the forefront of our consciousness death. And over the last couple of years, I've taken or attended the funeral of just short of 20 people. Most of them have been well known, friends, relatives, deeply loved. Now, our subject this week has been life, what if there is more? And this evening, as we come to the end of the week, future life, where is there real hope? And in the face of the realities of life and death, which we've been woken up to a sense to recognize, I want to take us to this famous statement by Jesus there in verse 25. If you look on page 34 of the John's Gospel, this is an eyewitness account of Jesus' teaching. If you look on the left-hand page, there at the top, verse 25, Jesus said to Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life." And from this incident, what I want us to see is first and most importantly that Jesus understands death. And secondly, and somewhat disturbingly, Jesus has authority over death. And third, reassuringly, Jesus offers us life in the face of death. First, he understands death. Now, we break into this account midway through. Jesus was great friends with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. On more than one occasion, he is found at their home. Lazarus had just died, and he's died early. And you'll notice in verses 28 through to 37, the paragraph that says Jesus wept, there are three expressions of emotion on the part of Jesus as he reaches the graveside of his friend. You'll notice that both Martha and Mary separately say, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would never have died." They recognize there was something supernaturally phenomenal about Jesus Christ. But then when Jesus gets to the tomb, verse 33, when he saw her weeping and the Jews who'd come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. He said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Now, this is most important. The phrase deeply moved is a phrase that is used elsewhere in Greek literature of war horses as they go into battle. It carries a sense of anger, almost fury. The phrase greatly troubled is used of water when it is stirred up. He's churned up inside. He's deeply troubled. And then there's the shortest sentence in the whole of the Bible. Jesus wept. And I say this is most important because in our statement there, where Jesus says, I am the resurrection, that little phrase, I am, it's actually the name God takes for himself in the whole of the Bible. And so by using the self-designation I am, Jesus is taking God's own name for himself. He does it on at least 9, and indeed several other occasions in this gospel. And the people who hear him realize what he's saying when he says it. On one occasion, he says, before Abraham was, I am, and they picked up stones to stone him. They realize he's claiming to be God. And now Jesus Christ of Nazareth stands here at the graveside, or just short of the graveside in the house, and he says, I am the resurrection. And Jesus, therefore, as God, understands death. And if I can put it like this, empathizes. Now, I've just spoken at the 4 o'clock congregation, and I know that there are at least 3, possibly 4 members of that congregation who themselves have been at the graveside recently. As I mentioned, I've officiated numerous funerals over the last months, many of them profoundly moving. On one occasion, 2 teenage boys were carrying the coffin of their father. I remember first attending a funeral of service of somebody. I was part of this congregation. I mean, not this congregation, but I was in this church in the late 80s. And of course, we were all as you are. And I remember when we first went to the funeral 15 years later of somebody who was part of the congregation. It was like a kind of extraordinary experience. Here we all were, 15 years further on. And it is profoundly important that we realize in the face of death, which all of us will experience, every single one of us here, and the death of loved ones, that Jesus understands death, that God understands death. And the sense of fury, of indignation, comes because death in God's world is an imposter. It was never meant to be there. Death entered the world as we rejected God, rebelled against God, and as it were, cut ourselves off from the author of life. As we rebel against God, he responds, and we face death. But God senses the imposter nature of death, and so Jesus at the graveside of Lazarus is angry. But he's also churned up, and you may well have experienced that at the death of a loved one, and Jesus wept. There is an approach to death filled with bluster and bravado that is profoundly cruel, almost, you might say, wicked. The kind of Marcus Aurelius, stoic, stiff upper lip, death is nothing. This novel by Louis de Bernier, you may have come across it. There's a film, Captain Corelli's Mandolin. As always, you know, the film doesn't capture the book, as we were hearing earlier. But there's a scene here where death is being reflected upon. Since I encountered death, I've come to the conclusion that death is not an enemy, but a brother. A perfectionist, he likes the young. He does all he can to meet us. He likes to befriend us, clap us on the shoulder, and make us laugh at all the pettiness and the folly of living, as if death is just some sort of friend. And when you experience death or the death of a loved one, to live with that kind of philosophy, I think it's profoundly cruel. And the beautiful thing we discover about the Lord Jesus is that he knows, he cares, he has experienced the stages of grief, anger at the face of death, turmoil at the face of death, grief in the face of death. He recognizes death. He weeps at death. He is deeply disturbed by death. He is angered by death. Death has entered into our world as a result of our rejection of God. Oh, says somebody, well, that's just typical of you Christians. You know, you look to Jesus as a crutch. To which I respond, I'll take that. I'll take that. I've been with people strong as an ox as they breathe their last. I've switched off life support machines. I've seen bodies lying in the midday sun, bloated through the heat, dead and rotting. And when you face death, well, let me tell you, you're going to need a crutch. One of my heroes as a mid-teenager was Clint Eastwood. You know, you can imagine, you know, mid-teens, rugged individualist and all the rest of it. I don't need help from anybody else. How entirely immature and childish. In Jesus, why we find somebody who understands death. God understands death. Now, there's much more to this incident. This is the incident that led to Jesus' own crucifixion. So let's return to our key sentence there in verse 25 at the top of page 34, where Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. First, Jesus understands death. Secondly, and most disturbingly, and I use that word advisedly, most disturbingly, Jesus has authority over death. You know, there's much, much more than meets the eye to this sentence. I've spoken on it dozens of times over the years, and every time I see something more. We've already seen that Jesus uses God's name for himself, and that on its own is staggering. I am the resurrection. But look at that phrase, I am the resurrection. You know, at first you read it and you think, oh, Jesus is saying, well, I will rise. And then you look at it again, you think, oh, well, I am the resurrection, I will raise Lazarus. And then you think, put in its, well, what is it saying? And then you put it in its context. And you look at verses 23 and 24 and you realize he's saying much, much more than that. So, Martha says, even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to Martha, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection. So now the resurrection on the last day, now what is that? Oh, the resurrection of the last day speaks of a final day at the end. The resurrection, then, is not my resurrection or even necessarily initially Jesus' resurrection or indeed Lazarus' resurrection. The resurrection is the day of judgment when all will rise. It's common understanding in Jewish thinking. The resurrection tells us that history is not circular. History is not molecular, little atomized bits. History is linear. The resurrection tells us we are coming from somewhere and we are going to somewhere, that there is an event, that it is the resurrection on the last day. And now Jesus stands here, he takes God's name and he says, oh, you know everything you believe about the last day and the general resurrection of all who have ever lived to judgment, that's me. I am the resurrection. Ah, says somebody, I really have come to the madhouse. Are you telling me that my great-great-great-grandmother is one day going to be raised from the grave to meet Jesus in judgment? And the answer is yes, that's exactly what Jesus is saying. I love speaking on this in this building because as you look around this building, you'll see there are monuments to people who died literally centuries ago. People come in here and say, your building is so old. Yeah, it is. It is. It is old. Over there is Sir Thomas Gresham's tomb. It's a sort of what's known as a table tomb. He died, I mean, way back when. Just behind, on the left, my left, your right, over there is Earl Spencer's tomb. That's an ancestor of Princess Diana. There's a guy called Julius Caesar buried just behind me here. Not the Julius Caesar, but another one. He will rise at the resurrection, says Mary, am Arthur. I am the resurrection. There is a day when Jesus will summon all who have ever lived to judgment. But where's the evidence? Angela and Paul, they were both talking about objective evidence. Where's the evidence? The evidence is there in verses 38 through 44. Please notice the detail. Jesus, deeply moved again, we're at the top of page 35 now, came to the tomb. Notice how detailed this. This is eyewitness testimony. It's courtroom stuff. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Mary, Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he's been dead for 4 days. Yes, that's precisely what happens. I had a friend whose surname was Lazarus. And in the old versions, when you were reading this, Martha said, but Lord, Lazarus, he stinketh. And you can imagine this poor boy when he was at school assembly and all the rest of it with all the other 9-year-old boys. He used to get in the most terrible. Anyway, there we go. By this time, there'll be an odor. So decomposition has happened. He's been dead for 4 days. Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Jesus lifted up his eye and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. So this is a deliberate miracle, a sign to enable us to believe who Jesus is, that he is the resurrection and the life. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who died came out, his hands and his feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. Unbind him and let him go. One wag has suggested, it's just as well he named him. Otherwise, they all would have come out. With just a word of command. And out walks Lazarus. Ah, you say, yeah, you just made this up. Really? No. Because as you look on down the column, verse 45 there, the plot to kill Jesus, Jesus' enemies who are wanting to get rid of him find that they cannot deny the miracle. Instead, they determine to murder Jesus. And you know, resurrections of rotting corpses didn't happen in the first century either. You sometimes hear people say, oh, well, these were just ignorant peasants and they believe anything. No. They lived in the same world as us. Don't be so ridiculous. And then somebody says, but this is an event 2,000 years ago. It's got nothing to do with me. To which Jesus will reply, yes, it's got everything to do with you. Because if Jesus is the resurrection, I am the resurrection, then one day Jesus will summon you from your grave to meet him in judgment. And this incident with the resurrection of Lazarus, indicating Jesus' authority over death, is matched in John's account by Jesus' own resurrection. I'd love you to take this away and read on, and you'll find in chapter 20 that Jesus himself then rises from the grave, unlike Lazarus, never to die again. I am the resurrection. He has absolute authority over death. He triumphs over death because through his own death, he carries God's judgment at our rebellion against God, and with the judgment and punishment paid, inevitably then he rises. He has conquered death. He has authority over death. He is Lord of death. He is the resurrection and the life. And so I say disturbing, and I say disturbing advisedly and after careful thought, because it is disturbing. It means that one day, whether you like it or not, you will meet Jesus as your Lord and judge because he has authority as Lord. He is the resurrection and the life. First and most importantly, Jesus understands death. Secondly, and somewhat disturbingly, Jesus has absolute authority over death. Third, and reassuringly, Jesus offers us life in the face of death. And once again, the key sentence that we're looking at has much more in it than we initially realized. Just look at verse 25 again, would you? I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus then takes this idea of life and unpacks it. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. That is, yes, you die, but you will live at the resurrection when I summon everybody from the grave. If you believe in me, you will have life with God for eternity at the resurrection. But then everyone who lives now and believes in me today will never die. If you put your trust in Jesus Christ today, he is the one who gives you life today, now, from God, that will never be extinguished. And so what he's promising there is, well, it's the same thing, but looked at from two different directions. One, yet you believe in me, you will die. Well, you will die, and then ultimately, you will rise to eternal life with Jesus forever if you trust in Jesus. You believe in Jesus and you'll now have the life of God dwelling within you, and that will continue right through your death uninterrupted. There's something inextinguishable. And I say this is profoundly reassuring in the face of death. Though he die, yet shall he live. They excavated the catacombs under Rome, and they found the tombs of Christian believers. This is just in the decades after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And beneath Rome are the excavations, which we call the catacombs, which were at once temples and tombs. When the Christian graves have been opened, the skeletons of the Christians tell their own terrible tale. Heads are found severed from the body. Ribs and shoulder blades are broken. Bones are often burned from fire. But the inscriptions on the tombs breathe forth peace, joy, and triumph. Here lies Marcia, put to rest in peace. Lawrence, victorious in peace and in Christ. You see, for the Christian, oh yeah, you will die, be in no doubt about that. But as you die, trusting in Jesus Christ, though he die, yet shall he live. The non-Christian tombs. Live for the present hour, since we are sure of nothing else. Once I was not, now I am not. I know nothing about it. It is no concern of mine. I mean, that could have been written in the 21st century, couldn't it? One of my favorite tombs, I'm not that weird, but one of my favorite tombs in this building, and because I've been here for, you know, well over 25 years now, I've sort of wandered around every now and then, but one of my favorites is just around the corner here, and it's up above head height. You might like to go and look at it afterwards. Charles Chamberlain, and he died in the 17th century in memory of his dearly beloved wife, who died on August the 16th, 1687, and of his fourth daughter, Hester, who died on the 9th of June that same year. You can almost feel the grief, can't you? And you'll see at the bottom, it says this, in expectation of a joyful resurrection on the last day. Thus contrasts the non-Christian funeral and the Christian. I tend to turn up to take funerals about an hour early. I hate the thought of being late for somebody's funeral. And therefore, I frequently catch other funerals before the one I'm taking in the crematorium. And I hear quite a lot of secularist funerals. Utterly bleak. No hope. For the Christian, whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. But then everybody who lives and believes in me shall never die. And so Jesus, who is the final resurrection, by saying, I am the resurrection, in himself, personal, here and now. And Paul put this to me after hearing the talk very clearly. I almost want to get him up here to say it again, which he nearly did just now. But what Jesus, by using the present I am, he is bringing the final day almost into the present and saying, well, look, I am the resurrection. I will raise you to judgment. But if only you will trust in me today, not only will you have life beyond the grave, but you will have resurrection life today. Life with your Creator. Life with God. Life that can never be snatched away. Life of eternity. Well, our time is up. We could probably spend another hour and a half thinking about just those few words. But what I want to say as we close, I want to encourage you, if you're here as somebody who's exploring the Christian faith, to take hold of this account of Jesus' life, written by the eyewitness John, who was Jesus' closest disciple, to take hold of it and read it, to explore it for yourself, and you will find it is both objectively true and experientially true. Make sense of everything as you come to Jesus. John wrote it so that we might believe. He had that express purpose. So would you do that? I'd love you to do it. Think about the Christianity Explore course. There's a table at the back there. I think Philly's going to be at the table there, and one or two others. I see Richard's there as well. Go and talk to them about doing the Christianity Explore course. Just 1.5 hours once a week for 7 weeks. It begins very soon, and it's what Paul and Angela got involved in all those years ago. But let me leave you with this. If you have no trust in Jesus, may I ask you what hope you have in the face of death? You will certainly die. Where is your hope? What will they say about you as they stand around your grave? What confidence do you have?